The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. On today's show, we're going to talk about harm reduction and supervised consumption sites. A federal judge on October 2nd ruled that the federal crackhouse law does not apply to supervised consumption sites, clearing the way for Safe House, a Philadelphia nonprofit, to start opening a legally sanctioned supervised consumption site. It would be the first in the United States. Activists around the country are celebrating that victory and are moving forward with plans for their own areas. We'll be talking about that and hearing about that in a bit. But first, loyal listeners will know that I've been talking quite a bit about the vape crisis over the last few weeks. There's a lot of misinformation that's going out, especially via social media, about what's happening. The bottom line is that the Centers for Disease Control and state health agencies do not yet know what is causing these vaping illnesses, these vaping-related lung injuries. They do not yet know why people are getting sick and dying. Anyone who is telling you that they know the cause or that it's this thing or another is blowing smoke. The reality is we don't yet know what's going on. There is some misinformation out there, and I think the best way to counter it is just to give you some of the facts. For instance, this is a portion from a news conference on September 26th. Oregon's state health officer, Dr. Dean Seidlinger, was holding. This is Dean Seidlinger's response to a question from a reporter.
Speaking of those products, you said they were cannabis products. Were these products that were licensed to be sold in the state of Oregon, or are these what are termed black market products?
For the products that were used by the people in Oregon were all from licensed retailers. That is not the case in all the cases across the nation where there's been a mix of products that have come from licensed retailers as well as unlicensed retailers. But in Oregon, all of the folks who've been reported to have this injury have reported having licensed cannabis products.
It was Dean Seidlinger, MD's Oregon State Health Officer. To repeat, patients in the state of Oregon with vape-related lung injury, including the two who died, appear to have gotten their vape carts from legal, regulated dispensaries. They were not coming off the illicit market. We do know that there are problems with illicit market out there, but we do not know that that is entirely what the source of these problems are. And in fact, in the state of Oregon, it seems that these folks got them through the regulated market. So there is more going on than we know about. Now, there's also, I've been trolled on Twitter a bit, from some of the people from the vape industry. They've been claiming that, oh, we're regulated by the FDA, we have to jump through so many hoops, look at all these things we have to do. The problem is, they haven't actually done that. These pre-market tobacco product authorizations have not actually been filed. Most of the industry is actually operating in some respects illegally, and the FDA has been letting them get away with it. Don't have to take my word for it. Straight from the horse's, well, mouth, Acting FDA Commissioner Ned Sharpless, MD. He testified before the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations of the Committee on Energy and Commerce on Wednesday, September 25th. The hearing was entitled Sounding the Alarm, the Public Health Threats of E-Cigarettes. We're going to hear now an exchange between Ned Sharpless, Acting Commissioner of FDA, and Representative Diana DeJette, who is the chair of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations.
Now, Dr. Sharpless, the 2009 Tobacco Control Act gave the FDA the authority to put e-cigarettes under its regulatory authority, which the FDA did in the 2016 deeming rule. Is that right?
That's correct.
And in 2017, the administration extended the compliance deadline by 4 years for companies to submit materials to the FDA for review of the public health risks of e-cigarette products. Is that right?
That's correct.
And is it accurate to say that e-cigarette products are only on the market because the FDA has exercised its enforcement discretion to allow them to remain on the market and not because the products have been reviewed by the FDA?
All INS products currently on the market are illegal. They have not been reviewed by the FDA.
Okay. And in fact, your testimony says, quote, no INS product in the United States is on the market legally, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so you also agree with the CDC that e-cigarette products are not safe. Is that right?
E-cigarette products are not safe. They are not without harm.
Okay. So here's my concern. Both FDA and CDC says e-cigarettes are not safe. We're seeing an explosion of young people using the products, and now we're seeing serious illnesses around the country, but FDA still allows these products to stay on the market even though they haven't undergone a full market review. So I think time is of the essence, and I'd like to ask you, Dr. Sharpless, when does the FDA intend to use its regulatory authority to assess the health impact of these products?
I agree with you. I think time is of the essence. I think the context of the history is perhaps important. In 2017, when that light regulatory touch was taken, the data at that time showed that youth use of those products was sort of leveling off or going down. And therefore, I think the FDA, being a science-driven organization, opted for that policy at the time. Then what happened, as you've described, is this epidemic of youth use.
Right.
And now we've accelerated our timeline. We've stepped up enforcement. We've stepped up education. And I can tell you, we are on this problem.
So what is your timeline?
The next major development will be the finalizing of this compliance guidance, which will have the effect of removing non-tobacco flavors from the market, and we expect that to be weeks.
Okay, and then what are you going to do after that?
So typically when a guidance is finalized, it has 30 days to go into effect or some period along those lines, and then we apply an enforcement strategy, which
so
we have
So is the flavors... Is the flavor strategy the only thing the FDA intends to do?
I can't speak to, you know, a guidance in process, but it is certainly the major target of that effort.
And why is that? Do you think that that's going to solve the youth vaping epidemic?
No, we do not believe that any single policy or process will solve the youth vaping epidemic. It's a combination of enforcement and education and multiple policy things that we're doing.
And are you continuing to review these products to see if they're inherently safe or unsafe?
So all products, INS products, will have to submit an application to the FDA by May 2020.
Okay.
And so very soon, everything should be coming in, but flavors would be removed from the market sooner than that because of our concerns about the youth epidemic of use.
Okay. Just one last question. How far is the FDA prepared to go to protect the health and well-being of young people if it determines that these are unsafe?
The FDA is a science-driven organization. If the data support more aggressive measures, then we will take those.
How far?
We could ban all flavors, for example.
Thank you.
That was Acting FDA Commissioner Ned Sharpless, MD, testifying before the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations of the Committee on Energy and Commerce on Wednesday, September 25th. He was being questioned by the Subcommittee Chair, Representative Diana DeJet. Again, to emphasize what Dr. Sharpless just said, the reality is none of these nicotine vape companies are technically operating legally because none of them have actually filed their pre-market tobacco product authorizations. We don't know what's in those products. The companies are able to hide their ingredients. Sometimes they call them a proprietary mix, a trade secret. Sometimes they just... There's a... R.J. Reynolds has a product that they use for flavoring. They call that product simply butter starter distillate. Sounds innocent until you check what the FDA says butter starter distillate is, and then you find out it's largely diacetyl. Diacetyl has been implicated in lung injuries, especially with workers in microwave popcorn plants, because although it's a food additive that's relatively safe when you put it into food and then consume it normally, when you heat it to the boiling point and then inhale the hot gases that result, diacetyl can be dangerous. And diacetyl is going into tobacco products. Is it going into the vape products? Maybe, but a lot of them are withholding their ingredient lists. Now, take whatever position you want on bans. Bans are a stupid idea. Prohibition never works. But if we don't have full disclosure of what is going into these products, well, isn't that the purpose of regulation? I mean, we need to have drug safety testing at festivals. We should have it in city streets and at supervised consumption facilities, which we'll talk about in a moment. We should have it there. And the reason is, you need to know what's in that product. You need to know what's in that drug you're taking. People are selling these products legally, and yet we don't know what's in them. That's wrong. Regulation is supposed to mean enhanced product safety. It's supposed to mean testing. It's supposed to mean we know what the ingredients are. And yet, we're allowing the tobacco industry and the vape industry now to get away with, well, I won't say to get away with murder because that would be jumping to judgment. What they're getting away with is lying to consumers. They're lying to you and me. And that's got to stop. You're listening to Century of Lies. I am your host, Doug McVeigh. And we've been talking about vaping and harm reduction. And now we're going to talk about harm reduction and supervised consumption sites. On October 2nd, a federal judge ruled that the federal crack house law does not apply to supervised consumption sites. The U.S. Department of Justice and U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia had sued to stop a nonprofit called Safe House from setting up a supervised consumption site there in Philadelphia. Fortunately, with this judge's ruling, Safe House will be able to push forward, and around the country, activists are also moving forward with supervised consumption facilities. A lot of people have been waiting on this decision, and so this ruling by the judge that the feds were wrong is really, really encouraging and really heartening to people around the country. So today we're going to hear a little bit more about harm reduction and about supervised consumption sites. Liz Evans is the executive director of syringe exchange programs for the Washington Heights Corner Project and the New York Harm Reduction Educators. Liz is also one of the founders of InSight, which is North America's first sanctioned safe injection site located up in Vancouver, BC. Back in 2015, she was honored by the Drug Policy Alliance at their International Reform Conference in Crystal City. We're going to hear Liz's address to the Drug Policy Reform Conference.
I'm just going to first thank you for having me here. It's a really big honor to be around such incredible people and to be part of this struggle. And I feel like everyone's already said everything there is to know about the war on drugs, but I'm going to share a little bit of my perspective on the human rights and how really the war on drugs has created the conditions to make it absolutely impossible for drug users to have their human rights acknowledged. And also how that has resulted in a situation where there's pretty much no public outcry of that fact. And I know you all know that, and that many of you here are working tirelessly to create the kind of structural changes that we need to change things, while others of you who are here have had your rights stripped. So you know how fundamental this experience is because you're walking it every day in your lives. From my perspective, this war against drug users has raged on so long that the values of it have become almost they've seeped into our societal DNA, and they afflict people around the world in every corner of the world every day, and yet the values that we've adopted make us blind to seeing it. Over 25 years ago, for the last 25 years, sorry, I've been working with people who use drugs. And some people have described me in the past as a harm reduction activist, but my feelings about this term are very mixed. And that's because I think that the violations have taken place against people who use drugs can't really be remedied just by simple things like giving people clean needles. While I know that's part of the solution, the human rights abuses extend far beyond these sorts of interventions. Whether it's gun violence in the favelas of Brazil, or torture in the name of treatment in Cambodia, or mass incarceration in the US, I just really resent a monumental waste of resources being channeled into barbaric policies that only serve to oppress human beings. But what personally upsets me the most is that I've known so many and do know so many beautiful, kind, funny people who use drugs, who in their lifetime feel characterized by unutterable shame. They feel personally responsible for what is ultimately arbitrary and random, but an attack on people. In Bogota 2 days ago, I was asked by a TV reporter why we should even help people who use drugs, because they're delinquent, unproductive members of society. Like the refugees from Syria, we're blaming the victims the war has spat out. a war people are running from every day. Refugees of our drug war also seem to be threatening somehow by their very existence. We're afraid of them, we other them, we treat them with contempt, and we push them aside. For many people, simply using public spaces like a park bench is a problem. You can get hassled by a police officer or a security guard or even arrested. Community centers put on extra security guards to keep people who use drugs out. They can't walk into banks. They get refused service in restaurants. They get threatened by neighborhood vigilante groups, and they're often just randomly beaten up. And none of this is grounded on anything real except for the brutalizing conditions that we've created and forced people to live in, where there is a palpable fear of people who use drugs, and it permeates everywhere. The start of my career was as a nurse in a psychiatric emergency room in a very large hospital where I was young and idealistic and naive as a nurse. But I found I came very uncomfortable in this environment as I watched how certain patients would just annoy the staff. They'd do things irritating to the staff, and so the staff would respond with sarcasm or rudeness and sometimes even anger, which then created a series of reactions. The patient would slam a door or say something threatening, followed by being jumped on by an orderly, injected with heavy tranquilizers, and then the series of behavioral therapies. People being deprived of a towel, slippers, toothpaste, or locked in a quiet room. Drug users typically were denied pain medication. They were accused that they were pill-seeking, and by almost every care provider in the city, we felt justified kicking drug users out of healthcare. This was seen as appropriate. They didn't deserve help because they weren't, quote, treatment ready. We created these circumstances in which we dehumanized people from the very beginning. First, we robbed them of their rights. Second, we didn't provide them with any respect or dignity. And third, we blamed and punished them. So for the patients that came into the hospital with the most complex problems, we did almost nothing. In fact, we did the least. Can't medicate out poverty, can't medicate homelessness. We don't have medicines that heal social exclusion or end racism. And medication doesn't replace the inhumanity of the war on people who use drugs. I couldn't really articulate at that point why I felt so depressed and angry, but I left the hospital and I went to work in the community directly with people in an area in our community disparagingly known as Skid Row, where I started running a hotel housing project. And idealistically, I thought, oh, I can help people here. And we housed people that just didn't fit. But it was in this environment that I was forced to see my own human limitations, when I was confronted by very complex and intense human suffering. And it was here that I had to embrace my own human frailty and pain, because it was being mirrored back to me and everybody I met. While obviously people are not defined by their labels, 90% of the people that we housed were injection drug users, and lots were involved in the sex trade. About 50% had HIV, and everybody had a criminal record. Malnourished and suffering from third world diseases, I ran around trying to do stuff, but instead I just watched people dying. I found Freddie, who was hanging out of his bed, having aspirated on his vomit, and Joyce, who died of an overdose when she was working in the sex trade in another hotel. And Barb, who was Alexandria's girlfriend, grandmother, I found her alone in a rocking chair, dead with the needle still in her arm. Each day I'd walk to work feeling nauseous, wondering what it was I was going to find, understanding I couldn't do much, but at the very least, I could provide space. Space for people who were abandoned, people who were alone, people who I was watching suffer, but at least we could be with them together. And what was happening in our building was a microcosm of what was taking place across our community. With about 15,000 low-income residents, 6,000 roughly were injection drug users, and we had a very open public drug scene. We had very aggressive policing, and by 1998, the infection rate to HIV had reached what was known as saturation point. Across our province in that same year, we had one drug-related death every single day. Our neighborhood was called Four Blocks of Hell by the media. Over an 8-year period, over 60 women went reported missing. Women, mostly Aboriginal, mostly drug users, and mostly working in the sex trade. Angela, I knew well. When I filed the missing persons report, I was told by the police that she'd probably gone on holiday to Florida. Instead, we discovered that a serial killer for almost a decade had been driving women out of our community onto his farm, where he slaughtered them and threw them away with his pigs. Angela's DNA was found on the farm. In this brutalizing context, we struggled with what we could do. But creating space was actually radical and controversial, because we made a commitment to house people regardless. We created a non-eviction policy because we said our goal was just to create space where we didn't allow people to keep on running. Here, we talked openly about drug use rather than trying to hide it. We handed out needles, we trained staff to do CPR, we used Narcan, and we equipped ourselves with ambibags and airways. But just creating this space was controversial and challenging because it went against all of the dominant values and beliefs people had about addiction. We were told that people on crack were crazy, out of control, prone to violence, incapable of reason, that we should be careful not to house people on crack. And we housed many, and this was never our experience. We were criticized by doctors who called our approach dangerous. They said we were doing something grossly irresponsible. We should force them to leave the neighborhood, not let them live in our project. We were making them more likely to use drugs. We had to move them into abstinent environment. But counter to this, our community was a place where people felt accepted. While we were bereft of institutional supports or care, it was a community of misfits who were able to find friendships. And when we were able to provide this space of acceptance, their well-being improved. And over the years, we opened many other such spaces, places like a community bank, a dental clinic, hundreds of housing units, a drop-in center, crack pipe with a crack pipe dispensing machine, alcohol maintenance programs, an emergency shelter with a crack inhalation room, a women's specific low barrier treatment program, art gallery, grocery store, a soccer team, which is and we were able to open Insight.
About their drug use patterns, why they're here, why they need to use the site, and we tell them what the site can offer, and we make sure that they know that the site is for them. It's for their health care, it's an important social contact for people, it's an important place of respite. So after we've had that conversation, if they decide to sign up, we'll sign them up quickly and we'll give them a code name that they can use so they can use the site anonymously. After that, people can go into the wait room where they wait to get into the injection room, and the staff there to chat with them, find out how they're doing, and make sure that they feel comfortable in the site. They'll go into the IR, they'll be given a booth, they'll be shown the array of clean equipment that we have, which is broader than most needle exchanges can offer. We'll show them things like where the sinks are so they can wash their hands with some soap and water before they use. It's incredibly important, small things like that. They can talk to a nurse while they inject, they can learn safer injection techniques, they can see the nurse after they're done for some wound treatment if it's necessary. Then they can go grab a cup of coffee afterwards in the chill lounge or a cup of juice, and we can talk about some of the broader issues. We can talk about what it's like to live in the downtown east side. If this person's homeless, we can talk about housing. If this person needs methadone, we can get them in touch with that. If a person wants to talk about detox, we can tell them about on-site upstairs. Great site for people to go to, where we can just look at them, treat them as human beings, treat them with respect, and say, what are your needs?
These spaces together created what we sometimes think about as like a state within a state. This was essential to be able to legitimate the lives of the people that we were surrounded by. In a community where almost everybody felt a profound sense of self-hatred and a deep sense of shame, having this approach replaced punishment with kindness and coercion, just simply with space. One day, my friend Bud, who was on those previous slides, he was doing a writing group at our hotel, and he came to me with tears in his eyes, and he said, I've had enough. Whether it was the murdered missing women, the daily funerals, or the generalized horror of watching so much suffering, our paths and frustrations converged. We realized that talking about these things was no longer good enough. Action was required. We had to do something, and this was the beginning. We blocked traffic, we burnt reports, we built banners, we disrupted meetings, we found many flashpoints for activism, lots of them, whether it was police abuses in the media where they wrote weekly salacious columns against drug users, or when our mayor put a moratorium on funding for drug use programs, or when there weren't enough needles being distributed and HIV was still raging. We decided to focus on opening an injection site as our goal, and the journey to keep this site open, to open it and keep it open, required unbelievable tenacity and an enormous commitment, right up until the end. But in spite of hundreds of opposing forces in the form of politicians, community business leaders, scathing media articles, and a federal government that we had to fight all the way to the Supreme Court, InSight opened 14 years ago, and it remains in North America the only legally sanctioned demilitarized zone on this continent. It redefines the concept of inclusion for drug users because it tells drug users that above everything else, it's your life that matters. When I walked into that rundown hotel 25 years ago, I had no idea what I was getting into. But just opening up that space and fighting back was all we could do. Our community has always been a place of resistance, and the battle continues. However, there's some key shifts that we can celebrate that have taken place as a result of this approach. We now have hundreds of housing units. Some of them are new. We have some innovative and creative healthcare services that have specifically been designed to create space for drug users. Police now in our neighborhood don't arrest people for possession, but instead they direct them to InSight and they give them access to now what is a pretty big array of housing and supports because they know what people need is access to care and support. HIV transmission in our community has been virtually eliminated, and the life expectancy of people in our community has increased by 10 years. However, all of this is a drop in the bucket in the face of how much work we obviously have left, because we have to move human rights forward everywhere for people who use drugs. And this shift has to happen by us.
That was Liz Evans, Executive Director of Syringe Exchange Programs for the Washington Heights Corner Project and New York Harm Reduction Educators. Liz was also one of the founders of InSight, North America's first sanctioned safe injection site. She was speaking at the Drug Policy Alliance's Reform Conference about supervised injection sites and harm reduction. The Drug Policy Alliance has its International Reform Conference the beginning of November. It is in St. Louis, Missouri this year. You can get information at the Drug Policy Alliance website, drugpolicy.org, or go to the conference site at reformconference.org. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh and, of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.